Your heart. We have what I call Buddhist climate control. If you're feeling too hot, keep a cool head, stop complaining. And if it's too cold, keep a warm heart. That way we don't need aircon. But, sounds very nice. I often wonder that sometimes I was born in London, I like the cold, and sometimes it's so hot in here and I see people wearing jackets and blankets and I think, crikey, you're crazy. But different people, different places, so it doesn't matter. If you feel warm, fine. If you feel cold, fine. It doesn't kill you. So it's just learning how not to react and to make peace with whatever is happening. Our training when I first went to Thailand, that Ajahn Chah, the great compassionate one, sometimes I thought, no way. After our one meal of the day, which you had to eat a bit extra, so you're always a bit sleepy afterwards, and he would make us all go into this, it was called the old sala. And it was just brick walls with a low tin roof. No insulation, no ceiling. Just a couple of, maybe 1 foot above your head was the iron. And after our one meal a day, we'd have to go in there and meditate for 2 hours. And with the hot sun beating on the iron and cooking you. And you had to wear not just these robes, but your spare robe as well. And you were also allowed to bring as many blankets as you wish. And it was, at least it taught me one lesson. After that, I never complained about the heat again. That was hot. And in the opposite extreme, we had the stories of the Tibetan monks who would stay in the caves up in the Tibetan plateau throughout the whole year. And they didn't have aircon in those caves. They didn't have electric heaters or gas bottles or even wood. They had to use the power of their mind. And so they would train and train and train to endure cold and create their own heat. And before they were allowed to go out into the snowfields and meditate in the caves, they had to pass the test. At the coolest time of the year, they were taken out into the snowfields. At night time, when it's the most cold. And they'd have to take off all their robes and sit naked on the snow. Now in those days, there weren't any other people around. There weren't iPhones who could take pictures of naked monks. So it didn't really matter they weren't wearing any clothes. But they were allowed one blanket. One blanket. But the blanket would be dipped in the water of the lake, first of all, and wrapped around them. And with these freezing temperatures, and the wind brushing past the icy cold blankets, their test was they had to dry 3 blankets during the night time with their own body heat. And that was the test. So every time I feel cold, I remember that, and it's not cold anymore. And any time it's hot, I remember how I was trained with Ajahn Chah, and it's not hot anymore. So you will find, whether it's hot or cold, in this room, whether you think the aircon should be turned down or up or sideways, I don't know, but the people just all want it different ways, you will find that that is not the problem. It's not the heat or the cold is the problem. It's thinking about it is the problem. That is always the problem, because today's talk is on the obstacle of thinking. And how that if we can understand what there is in transcendent life becomes so easy, and meditation becomes so easy too. And of course, the first little story is one of my favorites, and I repeat this only because it's really helpful. It stops a lot of your external suffering. And that was the time when Ajahn Chah was building, I just finished building his main hall to replace the one with the low steel roof where you baked. It was hot season as well, not very nice, but anyway. In that new building, there was a huge amount of earth left over. And these senior monks, you're very lucky these days, monks here and Anagarikas, I don't exploit you that much. Not like Ajahn Chah did. I wouldn't be able to get away with that these days. Amnesty International, the International Court of Human Rights, they put me in jail for some of the things he did. But instead of hiring a bulldozer or an earth-moving machine, which they had, why would you need to pay good money when you had all these slaves, I mean monks, at your disposal? That's what he did. He got all the monks, wheelbarrows and shovels to move that earth. There's a lot of earth left over. And we only have one meal a day. Just in the morning time, and it wasn't that much either. The reason I'm fat now, because I'm just compensating for how thin I was when I was young. Just, you know, just middle way, just one extreme, the other extreme, so I can go to the middle. So anyway, I was really thin in those days, because we had to work really hard, and really bad food. But the one thing which I did have in those early days was faith. I was really inspired by a teacher like Ajahn Chah, really wise, you know, not sometimes what you wanted to hear, but what you needed to hear. So I was willing to help my teacher, you know, for a couple of days, do some hard work. And it was a lot of camaraderie with the other monks, and what they call these days bonding, helping one another out. So we were shoveling earth, pushing the wheelbarrows, until about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. We had these little lanterns, they used to call them hurricane lanterns, I think. Just to light the forest for us as we were working right till late. So he didn't have any time for a shower. He just, you know, went back to your hut and just collapsed on the bed. So after 2 or 3 days of that, you can imagine just, not just what you smelt like, but how you felt. Really dirty, your robes were all sweaty. And worst of all was the mosquitoes. Because, you know, the more sort of your metabolism goes up, the hotter you are, the more they come and bite you. But they say you're all itchy with the mosquitoes, but you know, you've done a very, very good job to help your teacher. So after 3 days, we finished the work, and I went to bed that night thinking, tomorrow morning, nice shower, wash my robes, do some meditation just to relax. You know, just and going on the inspiration of service. Now that night, Ajahn Chah left to go to another monastery. Me traveling around, going all over the place, that's just tradition. So, he left, and the following morning, the deputy abbot, a monk called Ajahn Liam, I really respect him too, he's a very great monk, he said, I've been looking at that pile of earth, and I really think it's in the wrong place. And he had a point to it. Where it was, you know, it wasn't that sort of attractive, and it was just too obvious, and a much better place is over there. So, okay. Another 3 days of hard work, pushing the wheelbarrow, shoveling the earth, being bitten to death by mosquitoes in the hot sun, no shower, getting stinkier by the hour. But after another 3 days, we finished it. Ah, 6 hard days of really long labor. Any union in Australia would not allow that at all. We'd go on strike. But we did it. And that was the night Ajahn Chah came back. And in the morning, he scolded us. Why did you put the earth over there? I told you to put it over this other place. Move it! And there's only a limit to the amount of faith you have. And I crossed that limit. That was just too much. And especially because all those monks, the senior ones, they never do any work. They just tell me what to do. They just sit in there talking to people all day, drinking cups of tea. It's all right for you to say move the earth. Why don't you come out and push a barrow, find out what it's like? So I was really upset. And I was so upset. Yeah, he started swearing. Now I would say, I don't know why people do this. You know, you swear in your own language so other people can understand you, but they understand what you're doing. Your body language is so obvious. And that's when one great monk, I don't know who he was, I can't even picture his face anymore, he came up to me, it wasn't Ajahn Chah, just a junior monk, and he said, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy, thinking about it is the hard part. And what a wonderful teaching that was. You can read all the Abhidhamma, you can actually hear teachings for a long time, read the suttas and study Pali. But those are the teachings which really make a difference in your life. I got it straight away. Pushing the wheelbarrow was easy. Thinking about it was a problem. And so I stopped thinking about it. And the wheelbarrow got lighter. And it was fun. And so we used to have races with the other monks, see who could get to the pile earliest. And if any monk beat me, you know, got there too fast, the next time I was shoveling some earth, I would miss the barrel and hit him. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, bad aim. We're just messing around, having fun. You know, young men playing around. And it was fun and it soon finished. 3 days went past very quickly when you weren't thinking about it. And, thank goodness, they both decided, the senior monks, that was the right place. So after 9 days I could take a rest and wash my robes. Must be really stinky. But the point of that exercise was, I learned my lesson. In life, whatever you're doing, doing it is easy. Anything in life is easy. But thinking about it is the hard part. It's always the case. Chemotherapy, doing it is easy. Thinking about it, that's a problem. If it's dying, dying is easy. You've done it many times. Thinking about it, that's a problem. Even meditating is the easiest thing in the world, but thinking about it, that's a hard part. Whatever you're doing in life, it's the thinking which is a difficulty. Which is one of the reasons, even in meditation, we don't think about meditation. We just let it happen. Doing it is easy. Jhanas, easiest thing in the world. What could be more easy than doing nothing? If you had to do something, study and put forth effort, wow, you know, okay, fair enough. You know, you have to, that's really, really something I admire. These people who are train for the Olympic Games. Oh, they go through so much pain barrier this, oh, I could never do that. I think they're really stupid doing that anyway, but nevertheless, I admire their sort of endurance and their effort. But, not in meditation. So, we know that thinking is the problem. So how can we lessen its power and control over us, especially in meditation? And so we have all these wonderful little techniques. I'm just using one of them, it might not work, but you put them all together and thinking hasn't got a chance. I sometimes feel sorry for thinking. Poor thinking, it had control over you for so many years and lifetimes. Now it's done for. It's toast. It's had it. So, the first thing about thinking is just what we call, the Buddha called from his teachings, the substitution. Instead of thinking, substitute it with something else. This is in the Buddha's teachings, how to stop these silly thoughts. What do we mean there? I already mentioned to you that you go outside, don't wear any shoes or socks, and just feel the texture of the ground under your feet. Feel it. Even if it's a stone, feel it. It's not going to kill you to walk on a stone. Take off your jacket so you can feel the cold. Or you can feel the heat. Don't insulate yourself from life. Because the more you insulate yourself, the more opportunity there is to think about life instead of experiencing it. So, this wonderful grounds here, just go and, what I was doing this morning, had a beautiful time just to be able to go out there and just half an hour just to go and sit on the stupa. Was I meditating? No. I wasn't doing anything. Because sometimes when you say meditating, for most of you it's something you're doing again. Another task to perform. You've got jhana to achieve. That's another thing on your list of things to get done. Get out of the way before you leave the retreat. Crazy mind of ours, but don't do anything. Just sitting there and just watching the clouds. Beautiful clouds this morning. It's amazing. Watching those clouds this morning, they were, looked perfectly still. I was looking to see if they could move. They didn't move. But they changed. They changed without moving. Hee hee hee. That is nice deep dharma. Just as when my mind doesn't move, it changes. It deepens, it develops. Just like the clouds in the sky. You don't need to do anything. You stand still. And that's when things happen. Movement out of stillness. Doing nothing. And everything starts to arrive. Brilliant, nice little... Nature teaches you so much. So, but if you're thinking, you can go for a walk all around this retreat center. And where have you been? You've been thinking about your fantasies, your past, your future. You haven't walked around this monastery at all. You know, you haven't been there when it was happening. You're thinking, planning. So, look, if you are going for a walk, please don't go for a walk with a friend. Go walk by yourself. A teddy bear is okay, because the teddy bear is wiser than you are. The teddy bear actually keeps noble silence. So, try and go silently, and just explore, and just be. Now when you are just experiencing the nature outside, well, it's a very nice wind this morning, just not strong, just a gentle breeze, cool breeze, coming over the retreat center, feel it as much as you can. And again, take off the jackets, take off the socks, feel, because that makes you alive. You are aware of your five senses, kaya gata sati, mindfulness of the body, especially the bodily feelings. It's between vedana sati and kaya gata sati, feeling the body and feeling the sensations of the body. And that is, you hear if you read the suttas, that is primary to all meditation. Experiencing the body. Because so often people rush too far into the mind and all they see is thoughts. Thinking, thinking, thinking. They haven't calmed themselves down enough yet. You live in the world. I spend a lot of time in the world as well. Having to do things. Think about things. Solve problems. Do stuff. It's part of my job too. You know, it's because I've been here the longest and just being the senior guy, you know, it's always the buck stops here. Well, I accept that, you can't sort of resist that. But, fortunately, Ajahn Chah's great teacher wasn't just, you know, teaching Dhamma for when you meditate. He all knew that his students, some of them would actually lead monasteries, so he taught us how to be leaders as well. Already said one thing last night. When people talk to you, it doesn't have to be a counselor or psychologist or even a monk. Each one of you are counselors from time to time. People share their problems with you. And of course, he taught me, if they're sharing their problems with you, talking with you, always be the dustbin with a hole in the bottom. And if I didn't have that training, I'd be worried about all the things you said to me. And thinking about, oh, that's terrible, how can I help her, how can I solve that problem, maybe I should... And I would go crazy with so much thinking, because after listening to a friend and hearing their problems, which is compassion, it's kindness, you have to do that, don't reject people. But also, you know, as soon as they are gone, the little door in the bottom of my dustbin opens up and it all goes out. It's just like a toilet. As soon as you have the interviews, as soon as you've gone, I press the button and all that conversation has gone down and out. Otherwise, you keep things. So that was one of his first teachings, how to stop thinking. But the next teaching is, I don't know why people keep thinking about the past. And the great teaching was from Ajahn Buddhadasa. Many of you heard these teachings before, but I'm reinforcing them because they fit into this talk and you remind yourself of them. That was when he was building his hall. All monks build halls. Fortunately, we built our halls now. And the Dhammasala, you built your hall. Woohoo! Finish! Now you can relax. If you know how to. Why are some people always building something? Something's a bit restlessness, isn't it? So anyway, when he had half finished his hall, it was the rains retreat. And this rains retreat period from July to October, it's our tradition, it's a brilliant tradition. Yeah, it doesn't matter, you might go travelling around and doing stuff, but that is the time the monks and the nuns stop. You don't go anywhere. It's called a rest period. Which means the rest of the monks have a nice time when I have to teach them. That's why it's called rest period. But rains retreat started and his hall wasn't complete yet. So he sent all of the builders home. Come back in 3 months' time when the retreat is finished. Now we're meditating. We want some silence and peace. And a few days later, a gentleman came. And that gentleman asked him, when is your hall going to be finished? And that's where this great monk gave an answer which I have valued for so many years and I'm sharing with you. He said, it is finished. What do you mean? Said the visitor. There's no glass in the windows, there's no roof above, there's cement bags all over the place. Are you going to leave it like this? What do you mean it's finished? At which this great monk replied, sir, what's done is finished. And then he went off to meditate. What a beautiful piece of wisdom that is. What's done is finished. Have you tied up all your loose ends yet? Of your work, your family, your problems, your monastery? No way. I have so many loose ends. There's more ends in my life than are loose than are tied up. Same as yours. But it doesn't matter. What's done is finished. Now I'm on retreat. That is how we let go of the past. If you think you've got to get everything finished first of all before you can meditate, you will be finished first of all. You will be dead. So don't get into tying up all my loose ends. I'll just get this done and then I can meditate. That is, I've told this story for a long time, but this is, have you ever heard of the monkey mind in Buddhism? This is the real monkey mind, not the one which people say, you know, running all over the place. That's not the monkey mind. This is the monkey mind. This, the Sri Lankan told me this story, brilliant story. He said it was Vaisak Day, Buddha's birthday, Enlightenment Day, Passing Away Day in Sri Lanka. And anyone from Sri Lanka knows what a big festival that is. Everybody goes to the temple, and even the monkeys go to the temple as well. Not because to worship the Buddha. We always know there's lots of food at the temple, and because there's so many people, surely that somebody's going to drop a banana or a mango or something, and that's what the little monkeys can eat. So it's a feast for them as well. So one of the monkeys went to the temple on Vaisak Day, and as he was in the temple, waiting for someone to drop a mango so he could steal it and run away, he heard the monk giving the sermon. And he heard the words, monkey mind. And the monkey thought, he's talking about us. What's he talking about? You know when, you know, you get really sort of, you talk about somebody, you know, like Anagarikas or like Indonesian girls, and you think, wow, talking about me. You get interested. So, he started listening. And what he heard shocked him. This monk was saying a monkey mind is a bad mind. It's a mind which needs to be disciplined and trained so the monkey mind is no longer there. And he would say, this is offensive. This is not fair. What's wrong with a monkey mind? I have my rights too. You should respect me. Even though I'm not the same species as you, this is discrimination. And the monkey was really upset. You know, putting down and bagging monkey minds. So he went down back to the forest and he complained to all his fellow monkeys, a whole troop of monkeys. And they were all jumping up and down saying, they can't do this to us. Not in our modern world. We've got to respect, you know, people of different sexual orientations, people of different sort of intellectual abilities. You can't discriminate against age or about race. This is species discrimination. You can't allow this. We've got to report this to the World Wildlife Fund, Amnesty International, Court of Human Rights and Animal Rights and everything else. This is not on. And they're all jumping up and down complaining. And that's when the head monkey, who was very old and wise, he said, that is the monkey mind. Jumping up and down, complaining. And all the monkeys were wise enough to realize, oh my goodness, he's right. Monkey minds are bad minds. And so they asked the senior monkey, "So, what can we do about this? Is there any way to overcome our monkey minds, especially because we're monkeys?" And the head man said, "Well, look, I've been to that temple as well. And I've heard these teachers actually say, if you meditate, you could transcend the monkey mind." So all the monkeys said, "Yeah, great idea." They were jumping up and down, saying, "Yeah, let's meditate, let's meditate." He said, "Monkey mind again, shut up." And so I said, "Well, what do we do?" He said, "Well, I've seen these people in the temple. First of all, they get little cushions to sit on." "Yeah, let's get a cushion, let's get a cushion." So they all went to the forest, they got some grass, and they put all the grass together and they made each other cushions. And so I said, "Great, great, now what do we do?" "Well," said the head monk, "I'm not quite sure, but you sit down on your cushions." They all sat down on the cushions. "Yeah, what do we do now?" And I said, "You sit down, back straight, right paw over the left paw, your thumb slightly touching, close your eyes and watch your breathing." "Yeah, yeah, yeah, good idea." And they all jumped up and down. He said, "Now come on, follow it." So they all sat down, put their back straight, the right paw of the left paw, thumbs slightly touching, closed their eyes. And the forest had never been so quiet. A couple of hundred monkeys all meditating for about 30 seconds. And one monkey opened his eyes and said, "I've got a question, I've got a question, I've got a question." And they all opened up, "Yeah, yeah, what is it, what is it, what is it?" I said, "Don't you remember," he said, "we planned, we made this agreement to go to the nearby banana plantation when all the owners were in the temple, to raid the plantation, steal as many bananas as possible, now for our lunch." "So yeah, yeah, we've got to do it now before these people come back from the temple. Yeah, good idea." They said, "We'll just do that first of all. Get it out of the way so then we don't have to think about it." So they all got up from their seats, it's only about 30 seconds, a minute at most, and they swung over to the banana plantation. They got all the bananas, but it wasn't lunchtime yet, so they put it all in a big heap. So they got that out of the way. They didn't need to think about it now. And they sat down on their seats, back straight, right paw over the left paw, thumbs touching, eyes closed, watching their breath. And for a second time, the forest was quiet. For about 45 seconds, "Excuse me," said one of the monkeys. "Excuse me." He said, "You know, I've been thinking, before we eat those bananas, we have to peel them. So let's get that out of the way first of all. And once they're peeled, I don't have to think about this." And the other monkey said, "Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, let's do that." Because that way we can overcome our thinking, we get everything out of the way first of all, and then we can meditate peacefully. So we all got off their cushions, peeled all their bananas, they didn't eat anything yet, put it all in a big heap, went back on their cushions, right paw over the left paw, thumb slightly touching, close their eyes, back straight, watching their breath. You know what's coming next, don't you? "Excuse me," said another monkey, "I've been thinking." You know, it's true. Before we eat those bananas, we have to put them in our mouth. "Yeah, I've been thinking the same," said the other monkeys. "Let's get that out of the way first of all." So they jumped up and they all put a banana in their mouth. And monkeys being exactly the same as human beings, there was a few monkeys put two bananas in their mouth. And there's always one who puts three in their mouth. Greedy monkey. But they didn't eat the banana yet. They just put it in their mouth just to get it out of the way. So they didn't need to think about it. Sat down on their cushions, right paw over the left paw, back straight, head slightly down, close their eyes. And guess what they did as soon as they everyone's eyes were closed. They ate all those bananas while no one was looking. And that was the end of their meditation. That is the monkey mind. Let's get this out of the way first, and then we'll meditate. Let's get this thought out of the way. Let's solve this problem. Let's complete this fantasy. Let's have all the plans for the future all set out. When everything is ready and done, then we'll meditate. And of course, you never meditate that way. So that is a monkey mind. I'll meditate later once this is out of the way. Ajahn Buddhadasa did the opposite. No, what's done is finished. It is out of the way. Even though many people think it's incomplete. Doesn't matter. Silence has greater priority. And that comes up to the next really important thing. If thinking is more important to you, then of course you'll think. If silence is more important and valuable, then the silence will overcome the tendency to think. So that's why we do a marketing campaign against thinking. Honestly, you've been alive for long enough now. Where has thinking really got you? Does it really answer problems through thinking? Not really, it just creates more problems. And I've always noticed the real way to solve problems is through silence. Just like the old story of you can't remember somebody's name. Keep thinking about it, oh, hopeless. Forget about it and the name comes up. You do an examination, first answer comes up, the first solution comes up, and you start thinking about it, no, that can't be right. And you put something else down and you get it wrong. That first answer is usually, which doesn't come from thinking, that's usually the correct one. So too often that we've been brainwashed into assuming that thought is accurate. It never is. As someone once said, you think about something, just like a satellite going around a planet but never landing. But seeing, experiencing, you go right into it. That's where you land on the truth. Oh, like that simile I did at Nuns Monastery some years ago. I was there and I just wanted to give a very quick teaching, but not just give a sermon. So I asked, where is the toilet? This was in the nun's cottage, the old cottage. And I knew where that was. I've been in that hundreds of times, visiting that place. And Hasapanya, Venerable Hasapanya, so polite point out, just over there. Oh yeah, sure enough, there was the sign on the door. Toilet. So, I didn't actually do this, but I pretended to stand outside of that toilet and urinate on the door. I said, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? Well, you said that's where the toilet is, and you were right, it's got the name toilet on the outside. So that's the toilet. So I'm doing what you told me to do. He said, no, Ajahn Brahm, the toilet is inside, the sign toilet. That is not the toilet. And I said, well, look, you should put a proper sign up there. Don't say toilet, but toilet inside. But that is an object lesson. Now, that's what the thoughts are. Sometimes the thoughts are just signposts. We stop at the thoughts, so we never really understand what they're pointing to. So we just end up urinating on toilet doors rather than going inside where you're supposed to do your business. So, understanding that thoughts are not the truth. They're pointing to something, but they're not the place where they're pointing to. Then that takes away a lot of the importance of thoughts. And how many times I've been discussing the Dhamma with somebody, and it's just thoughts, it's just ideas, just philosophies, but no real experience. Which is why we need to shut up to experience life. Thinking has just got you headaches. It does not solve problems. It makes more problems. Check that out. Don't think about it, but experience it. There's so much truth to that. Also, thinking is just a burden. So heavy on the head. So when you have some silence and peace, it's so much more beautiful. As I said on the first evening, the space between thoughts is delicious. Silence. That's what it's like not to be thinking. What can you compare the two? Which is preferable? So once you do a little marketing campaign for yourself, that silence is healthier, much more enjoyable, and much more conducive to insight than thinking will ever be, then you have an understanding of why you should value silence rather than thought. But whenever silence actually arrives, please be careful, because silence is very shy. If you say her name, she runs away. All silence. And it's gone immediately. So if silence actually comes and becomes your friend, don't even say her name. Just let her be. So, once you value silence, then how do we start to generate silence? And I went off on a tangent there, but just learning how to use your senses without naming things, without thinking, without going into explanations, philosophies, working out its meaning. Sometimes, having been a scientist before, I tell people, look, if you're doing an experiment, you don't work out the conclusion until all the data have been received. You wait. Just receiving data, receiving data, receiving data. And only at the very end do you draw your graphs and get your conclusions. But what happens for us, if we haven't got the data in yet, and we've already made our conclusion, we've already thought about it too fast. So the data of life, to experience life, you can think about it later. Which is why you can go for a walk and just feel the cold or the heat on your skin. Take off your shoes and just walk on the gravel. If it hurts too much, then put your shoes on, but at least do a little bit. Just have a look at the trees or the grass or the sky. Soon you run out of words to describe what you're seeing. One of the beautiful reasons, or one of the reasons why we have retreat centers in a place like this, is why we spend a lot of money on the gardens, to make them beautiful so that you don't need to think. You can just enjoy. Because when you're looking at nature, it's similar to listening to fine music. You don't think. If you're listening to a symphony, you will not be thinking anything at all. You'll not be thinking about your work, the future, or even any aches and pains in the body. You'll be totally absorbed just in every note which you're hearing through your sense of hearing. That's one of the reasons it's pleasant. Not because the music is nice, but also because it makes you silent for a while. Nature is the same, but far more subtle. You can listen to the sound of the birds. You can listen to the sound of the aircon, the sound of the wind rustling the leaves. You're becoming much more sensitive when you stop thinking. And it's a pleasant experience. So once you get into it, you don't need to use willpower and struggle to do this. Just open yourselves up to the beauty of the silence of nature. Again, we chose this place for a retreat center because it's not on a flight path. Birds again. There's not much traffic goes up Kingsbury Drive. It's a very quiet place, and even the animals in this forest don't make much noise. Over in Thailand or Singapore, Malaysia, you go in a forest and such a noisy place, the forest. Cicadas and animals and stuff going all over the place, the birds making a huge noise, even those pesky chickens in the morning. And I don't know why this happened to me. The last time I went to the Sakyadita conference. It's one of the reasons I'm not really all that keen to go anymore. I'm letting you know a secret. So this is the conference supporting bhikkhuni ordinations. It's supposed to be just mostly for women, for, you know, supporting them, but, you know, I go there to support them as well. And it was in Indonesia, in Yogyakarta. And I think I had to really hard time to get there because squeezing it in. So by the time I got there, I was really, really tired. And I had to give a long speech. And by the time you got back to the hotel, it was really late. But my supporters, I think it was you, wasn't it, Ping Pong? I shouldn't have said this, I'm in trouble now. But you sponsored this really nice room, a huge room. I think it was even called the presidential suite. Suwadee did, okay. The presidential suite. It's a big room, but you don't need a big room. You don't need a tiny bed to sleep in. But the worst of it all, I don't know why they have these in hotels. They had birds outside of every room. The one outside of my room was a chicken, a cockerel. And I'd only gone to sleep for about an hour. And this bloody bird, because of the lights, cock-a-doodle-doo! It's only 1 o'clock in the morning, bird! If I was a layperson without any precept, that bird would have been... Well, I can't do that. And it didn't stop. And it's right outside my room. I don't know what they did that for. I never got any sleep at all. That was really a terrible day. Anyway, ordinary animals, you know, they behave. They go to sleep at night because the lights all over the place. So they didn't know what was day and what was night, these birds these days. So anyway, that was no sleep that night. Oh, funny experiences you have. But anyway, there we go. In real nature, it's very quiet. That's why you come out here and it's just a nice place to be. And it calms you down. So if you're thinking a lot, go out and listen to nature. Feel the wind. And after a while, you do that enough times and it really makes you calm down. It does settle you down. That, where we had the last conference, the global conference over here, last year, had this one guy came up and he had a new therapy, psychology. You know, it's a scam, but, you know, give him credit. He thought about this before anyone else did. So anyone who had depression, ADD, or, you know, OCD, or an ABC, whatever else you call it, I don't know. It's all names, I don't know what they mean. But anyway, he would just put him in his car, he was in Sydney, and just drive off to, you know, the cliffs, or into a forest, or by some nice lake. You know, what a wonderful job that is, just driving people out to some of those beautiful parts of nature. Take them for a nice walk, and then bring them back again, and charge them a heap of money for that. Because it worked. You know, just somebody who was really stressed out, having some sort of emotional, psychological, whatever problem, just take them out into nature, realizing the therapeutic benefit of just listening to the birds. Or just, you know, being and seeing a beautiful sunset. I know, I think a few of you have done that already. The sunset time, just you walk over to the lookout and see the beautiful sunset. And it's, you know, a lovely thing to do. And it calms you down. So if you're really going crazy, and if you're really just so many thoughts, you go and watch the sunset and you can't think anymore. Because the sunsets are beautiful and you see them over the Indian Ocean. So, that therapy of going into nature and listening and opening your ears and your eyes and even your nose to the smells of the forest, especially if we do have a rainstorm. After the rain, the eucalypt forest smells so fragrant. It's not to be missed. And so then you are mindful, you're aware, you're not thinking. That encourages you to take the importance away from thoughts. But there comes a time sometimes when one gets really caught up in these thoughts. And that is when the question last night, you just have a joy ride. It is joyful sometimes because you don't have to put any effort. There was a story of this monk, he's a well-known monk, it's not myself, so I better not tell you what his name was. But he was staying with a very experienced and very powerful monk. And they would do a 2-hour meditation every morning before they went on alms round. You had to go to that 2-hour meditation. And in the morning, sometimes the heat, if you haven't slept too well, you felt really tired. It was always a struggle meditating for 2 hours. But one day he got so fed up, he decided, oh, I'm not going to try and meditate. I'm just going to have a sexual fantasy. And he said it was amazing. When he started to fantasize about sexual things, he said there was no pain in his legs at all. And 2 hours went by so quickly. But afterwards, he thought, when the bell went, he opened his eyes, oh my goodness, what have I just been doing? Because some of these monks can read minds. And when the teacher looked at him, he felt so guilty. And then the teacher walked right over to him in the middle of the meeting with everybody else looking, and he was so embarrassed and terrified. What is my teacher going to do? And his teacher looked at him and said to him, you've just been wasting 2 hours of your time, and walked away. It wasn't like a scolding, putting him down. It was just telling him how it was. You're just wasting time. But, he said, 2 hours, no pain, no struggle. That is a problem. We get caught in this. You get quick results, but long-term problems. It's not really solving the underlying issues. So, why do we get involved in those things? And that's the answer in the question. We get involved, we get entangled in them. And the solution for me came when I started watching other people on aircraft, watching the in-flight movies. Because I travel a lot. And so you see all these people with their headphones on looking at the movies, and you see them crying. You see them really scared. You see them laughing. Why? It's only a movie. And the key story which I love telling is from my youth, when boys were really boys and totally insensitive. Because when I was at college one day, 3 or 4 of my friends, male friends, we took our girlfriends to watch West Side Story. It was just an adaptation, very quite famous film at the time, adaptation of Romeo and Juliet set in New York. And there's always a tragic ending. It's Tony was the hero who fell in love with Maria. Tony was Italian. Oh no, the other way around. Tony was Puerto Rican and Maria was Italian. And those days, you couldn't marry outside of your group. But they fell in love. And the convoluted story was, just like in Romeo and Juliet, that Maria's brother was out to kill Tony, her lover. And she was racing through the streets of New York, trying to find him to warn him. And she finally saw him, and he was standing outside under the light of a lamppost in the middle of the night, in raining, dark, you know, the poor part of the west side of New York. And she shouted out to him, "Tony, Tony, be careful!" And as she was shouting out, the bullet left the gun of Maria's brother and hit him in the heart. And Maria ran over to him. "Tony, Tony." As Tony began to die in her arms, in the middle of the night, in one of the poorest parts of New York, an orchestra started. And they both sang, even though he was dying. "There's a place for us, somewhere, a place for us." And all our girlfriends, every one of them, started crying. And all us men started laughing. "You stupid, it's only a movie! What are you crying for?" We were so insensitive. And in those days, you'd get away with being insensitive. These days, you can't get away with that at all. You get hit. Or the relationship would be over. So insensitive those days. But, you know, there's some truth to that. Why? It's only a movie. I often say when I tell this story, don't worry about it. If you don't believe in reincarnation, wait a few minutes until the movie starts again, and Tony will be reincarnated. But the point was afterwards, why? Why did the girl start crying? Because they got pulled into the movie. They literally got involved, which means they got wound up into that movie. So much so that it was like they were in that movie. They were a best friend of Tony and Maria. They knew these people. The characters in the play or the movie had made connection. And it was like they were right inside. And I saw this myself with some of my friends watching a horror movie, Tarantula. Tarantula was a spider who had been genetically modified in a nuclear accident and was, you know, 100 times the size of a normal tarantula, was creeping up behind people, you know, eating them. But one thing I noticed here, in those days, I think it's still the same, people tell me because I haven't watched the movie for a while, these days, and those days, the tarantula, the monsters, the demons, they would only go after the beautiful girls and the guys protecting them. If you're a fat, ugly girl, you don't have to have any problem with monsters. They always leave you alone. Check it out. So, someone in the audience, you know, the tarantula is about to eat another beautiful girl, and someone in the audience said, "Hey, tarantula behind you." It's a movie, and they're in the audience, and they shouted out, "Look out, tarantula's behind you." Why did they do that? It's because psychologically you're actually in the movie. Just like when you watch sports matches. People say, "That's not LBW!" If you're watching cricket, Sri Lankans. "That's not LBW!" Now that's, you know, going out. But, and they're listening to that in Perth, and it's happening over in Colombo somewhere. They can't hear you. No matter how loud you shout in Perth, they cannot hear you in Sri Lanka. But still, now many of you Sri Lankan women have seen your husband do that. Why? Because when you're watching that match, you get so involved, you're right inside of it. As if you're actually at the ground and that umpire can hear you. And to me, that's to explain why people get involved with their thinking and fantasies. You're right there. If you start remembering the past, it's like you're there again. And you can actually fix it up this time and not make the same mistakes. You're like the movie of the past. Or the future. Fantasies, you can fix it up and make it just your way. As if you're right there. And these other fantasies, romance, sex or whatever it is, winning the lottery, it's like you're there, you're winning the lottery. Whatever fantasy you have, you get involved in it. And the way to overcome that, so simple, is actually just to stand back. Detaching, but I don't mean detaching in a philosophical way, is actually putting some space between you and what you're thinking about. Having a supervisor. Supervisor means someone who looks above, not inside. Just seeing it from a distance. Getting some perspective. If you do that, yeah, the fantasy's there, but you step back from it. Like you're sitting in your armchair and the fantasy's on the TV screen. When you put some distance between you and what you're seeing, what you're thinking about is just so ridiculous. So stupid. But when you're right inside of it, it's real and it's important. When you stand back, the importance, the reality is taken away. And then it's so easy to let go of it. When you're entangled right inside of it, it's real for you and you don't want to let it go. You can't let it go. It's important. You've got to wait till the very end. I remember one of these Anagarikas once. Actually, they hadn't become an Anagarika yet. And they told me, they said, they're not going to ordain until the last episode of Harry Potter comes out. And after they've seen that, find out what happens in the end. Then they'll ordain. That's crazy. Because they had to see it at the very end. That's how entangled we get, and we have to see what happens in the end. You know what happens in the end, it's always the same. The heroes always win, the bad guys always lose, you know, and then the earth always gets saved from disaster, and it's the end of the world. But the very last minute, the very, very last minute, Bruce Willis saves it. Or whoever else, that's another hero I remember. Against impossible odds. So you know what's going to happen in the end. So you don't have to worry. But the point is that in our fantasies we just get sucked in. So that's one of the reasons. So if you can put some space between you, but you have to want to put space between you. Because a lot of times you say, no, this is enjoyable. Because you're used to this. You're used to thinking. That's one of the other problems. It's the old simile, I use this many, many times, because it's the best psychological simile which you can understand. People in jail, they're about to be released, they don't want to go. Jail is suffering, they know it's suffering, there's more peace and happiness outside, but they're used to jail. Or like that other simile, the worm in the pile of cow shit, which you all know. And the heavenly being tries to take the worm out. I don't want to go. I don't want to go to heaven. Any shit up in heaven? Of course not. Then I'm not going. Because the little worm loves his cow shit. It's warm. It's fragrant. And it's my food. So I don't want to go to heaven. I like my cow shit. I don't want to be peaceful. I love my shitty thoughts. They're warm. They're my food. That's what attachment is. So the attachment to the thinking is always because there is some pleasure there. There is some joy there. Worms enjoy shit. But my job as a teacher is to try and trick you by any means to be quiet to realize that peace, silence, is much better than thinking. So you value silence more than thought. Just like for a prisoner, they're usually put out on weekend release, first of all. Maybe just work programs. A very gradual accommodation to life outside of prison. Just like here, you get accustomed, rehabilitated to life outside the prison of thought. Little by little, you have moments of peace. So nice. Underlying all of that, I'm going to go over time, but there's only a couple of interviews this morning, so I can do this. Underlying all of that, I've asked many, many people to realize that the thoughts, they can be visualized as waves on the surface of a lake. It's a helpful simile, metaphor. When you see them as waves on the surface of the lake, you understand how they don't give answers, but they distort the truth. If you look at the lake down below at night time, and if it's a clear night with no wind, then you can see this beautiful reflection of the moon and the stars. Now the moon is up in the middle of the night, just gone past the full moon. So you can actually see the reflection of the moon in the lake at night time. Only if there's no waves on the surface. If there's waves on the surface, it distorts the image. Even small ripples distort the image. But if you're lucky enough to go down to the lake and there's no wind at all, that's when the lake is glassy smooth like a mirror. And you can sit by the edge and you can watch the reflection of the moon, even the stars, perfectly. That is why only when your mind is still from thoughts can you get real insight, not distorted insight. That's when you know the truth of things, when there's stillness. Where does that stillness come from? The wind of wanting again, or you interfering. So, looking at your mind like a lake with waves. The waves are the surface phenomena. What creates those waves? What's underneath? That is like the wanting, the agitation, the doing. Thinking this is not good enough. Thinking that what's done is not finished, so you have to keep doing so. That keeps your mind agitated. So, for the last year or two, I've been asking people at the beginning of your meditation to start being mindful of the peaceometer. Anyone who's been to Nolamara have heard me say this so many times. Just like in a car, you have a speedometer. You have another indicator of how many revs your engine is going at when you need to change gear, how much petrol you've got left, how hot the engine is. You have all these meters on your dashboard which gives you feedback. So you know how fast you're going and you can adjust the pressure on the accelerator accordingly. And you get feedback. You just lessen the pressure on the accelerator, you see that needle go down. You push the accelerator down more and you see the needle go up. So that needle gives you feedback so you know how hard to press on the accelerator. We have something called a peaceometer in your mind. I can tell you what that is straight away. Right now, how peaceful are you or how agitated are you? Now you've just looked at the peaceometer. That part of your mind which tells you how peaceful or how agitated you are. I just gave it a name, peaceometer. It's not the best name, but at least people understand what I'm talking about. And after a while, when you keep looking at that peaceometer, how peaceful are you, how agitated are you, you soon get to be aware of it. With practice, repeated practice, you can become very aware, very mindful of the peaceometer. How peaceful are you? How agitated are you? And that's such an important thing to be aware of, that after you've relaxed your body, I ask meditators, the next thing before you can watch the breath, look at your peaceometer. Because if you are too agitated, it's a waste of time watching your breath. If you watch your breath, you're too agitated, the mind will wander away. Too many waves on the surface. So instead, when you watch the peaceometer, how peaceful am I, how agitated am I? Then you soon learn, once you're watching the right thing, you understand how to manipulate it. You soon learn how to move that needle to deeper and deeper peace. You feel yourself getting more and more peaceful. That's when you learn things like wanting, arguing with yourself or arguing with life just makes that needle move more towards agitation. Letting go. Embracing the moment. Opening the door of your heart to whatever's happening right now. That moves the needle to more peacefulness. So you soon learn, when you're watching the peaceometer, how to make your mind more peaceful. And you soon learn what makes it agitated. It's important to do that. Because if you look at that peaceometer first of all, then soon you can move that needle down so close to peacefulness that when you start looking at the breath, there's hardly any thoughts left. Basically, the thoughts are a symptom. They're not the problem. They're a symptom of a mind which isn't peaceful. So if you go to the underlying cause, you're agitated. That's when people are agitated. They think about anything, anything. They've got to think about something. The thoughts really aren't going anywhere. You know they're not going anywhere. It's just a symptom of an agitated mind. So go to the cause, right to the underlying essence of this thing. The peaceometer. Once you know what that is, and you get used to looking at it, you soon know how just to relax and make more peace in the mind. And you soon also learn, when it's peaceful enough, you just look at your breathing, and it's so easy. You calm the mind down first of all. Enough. So you can watch the breath, and hardly a thought comes. You've done the groundwork with the peaceometer. So, you can try that. You keep asking yourself, how peaceful am I? How agitated? And that thing which you're watching, that's the peaceometer. Be aware of it more and more and more times, and you soon learn how to manipulate it. And then begin the meditation, get your body nice, look at the peaceometer, calm that peaceometer down, and then go to the breath. And then problem solved. Sadhu. 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 Excellent. So best of luck with the peaceometer and with all those other things. Nice walks through the forest.